ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For decades, a quantum computer has been just around the corner. So, where is it?
If you'd asked me very early on, I would have been very pessimistic.
The race to build a quantum computer...
Then I got more pessimistic.
Can anyone actually do it?
And more pessimistic.
One of the biggest tech stories on Earth. I'm Jacinta Bowler. Search for Science Friction, Dead and Alive, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land. I'm David Marr. Oscar Wilde could have been talking about his own life when he said, "The truth is rarely pure and never simple." For Wilde is one of those figures, those mighty figures, that myths and lies cling to. Every collection of the wise and witty last words of the great includes Oscar Wilde remarking as he lay dying in a Paris hotel, "My wallpaper and I are fighting a duel to the death. One or the other of us has got to go." Bullshit. But that's one of the more harmless inventions that clings to Wilde's life and reputation. Correcting the record has become the life mission of his grandson, Merlin Holland, who, after a kind of conversion experience which we'll discuss, has written about Wilde's life, edited his letters, and now published After Oscar, The Legacy of a Scandal, about the painful aftermath of the playwright's death, painful particularly for his family. Merlin Holland joins us from Burgundy. Merlin, welcome to Late Night Live.
Hello, good evening.
Merlin, the wallpaper quote, how do you rate it?
It has all the ring of truth about it, and I'm pleased to say that you've quoted it in its full version and exactly, which is wonderful because most people don't.
But the great biographer of Wilde, who we'll be discussing, Richard Ellman, certainly doesn't say they are his dying words.
Another version of it is that he said he was dying beyond his means, which is
great.
Very Oscar. A touch of humour in those last sad years is something which never failed him, in fact.
No.
An old friend of his who just got married sent him an invitation to go to England and see her and her new husband, which of course he couldn't, he was so poor in France at the time. And he writes back to her and he says, "Miles of land, miles of sea, the purple of mountains and silver of rivers divide us. You don't know how poor I am, supposed to live on a few francs a day. Like St. Francis of Assisi, I am wedded to poverty. But in my case, the marriage is not a success." I mean, to be able to say that when you're on your uppers in your last years
is bloody marvellous.
It's a great character trait.
Now, your wish to get to the truth of Wilde's life comes after a long history of your family, your grandmother, your parents, your mother in particular, dissembling, hiding, misrepresenting Wilde. How does that record now look to you, looking back on all those decades of fibbing and pretending?
Well, I have to say, over the time that I've been writing this book, I've been able to categorise these myths, lies, exaggerations, and so on into about four different types. The first two are the polishing of the writer to improve his posthumous image. The second ones are even more venial. They are people who want to put bums on seats in cinemas or sell more books. So they over-sensationalise a life which is quite sensational enough in its own right. And the less reprehensible ones to me are false memory, where people simply remembered things wrong, or in the case of my father, tying up loose ends, stories which don't quite fit together, so you add a little bit which is totally fictitious and it ties all the loose ends up in a neat knot. I found myself having to undo the knot and explain why it was made in the first place. Some of these exaggerations are acceptable, I suppose. You just have to accept the fact that, you know, at a distance people remembered things wrong. But others, where I find, you know, it's a question of making more money out of Oscar Wilde, I've tried to blow them out of the water.
In the 1980s, having lunch with Barry Humphreys, you write that your mother denied that Oscar Wilde was gay. Now, that's just that's just ridiculous. Why did she do that?
This is Barry's Barry's account of the lunch which they had together. And I always thought, being a child of, you know, my early teenage years, and my mother tried to make out to me that, you know, it was all, a lot of the court cases were built on perjury by the witnesses and so on, and Oscar wasn't that bad, and Oscar wasn't really gay and so on. And it wasn't the sort of thing that a parent should really be saying to a child. Well, today, in those days, in my mother's defence, she had gone through a lot of press interest in her and my father, which was not very pleasant. And I think she was trying to protect me. And she went on trying to protect the family, as she saw it, well into her 80s. I thought that my false memory might have been that my mother was trying to tell me that Oscar wasn't really gay, until Barry pointed this out to me, and he said, you know, go and look at my, I think it was the second volume of autobiography. And there it is.
Indeed.
So my false memory wasn't so false after all.
Merlin, explain your mother's career in a few words. She was in her own way a most distinguished woman.
She was. She was born in Melbourne. Left Melbourne shortly before the war, came to England. She was in charge of a beauty salon in London, and the reputation of the company was such that she got, you know, the ladies in waiting from Buckingham Palace coming and having their faces manipulated and beautified and so on. And she saw a picture of the Princess Elizabeth, as she was then, looking knowledgeably into the engine of an ambulance. She was doing her war work. And she wrote to the palace and said, you know, I think it's about time this woman, young woman with beautiful skin, needs it looking after. And one thing led to another, and she was invited to the palace and saw the then queen, who said, yes, I think it's probably, you know, quite a good idea. And from then onwards, my mother was called to the palace probably three or four times a year to give first the princess and then the queen herself a beauty treatment. And indeed, she was asked by the queen to go to the palace on the morning of her coronation. And the queen said, I want you to give me a masterclass in makeup for the coronation.
Yes.
I want to do it myself. It's such a big day for me that I want to be on my own. But I'd like you to come to the palace just in case it all goes pear-shaped and I make a mess of it. And whether my mother asked or whether the Queen offered, I don't know. But I was taken along. And I spent the morning looking right up in those windows right at the top of the palace. I've got a very vivid memory of it, but only just that, of watching the coronation procession go off down the Mall in the rain, as it was.
Merlin, I had not expected that we would be talking about this, but it had to be talked about, didn't it? I'm talking to Merlin Holland, who has written After Oscar, The Legacy of a Scandal, about Oscar Wilde, his grandfather. Now, Merlin, back to the story. It would be fair to say, would it not, simply that the family was deeply ashamed of Oscar Wilde. Once he had been dragged through the courts and thrown into jail, they were ashamed. And that shame dictated what they did for about the next two decades.
Yes, I think that's correct. With one proviso, and that is that it was really Constance's family who were ashamed. There wasn't much left of Oscar's family. By the time Oscar died, his mother had died while he was in prison. His brother died shortly afterwards. And so there was really nobody left in the family at all, apart from the two little boys, my father and my uncle.
Whose names were changed?
Whose names were changed from Wild to Holland.
To what, from Wild to Holland? Where does the name Holland come from?
It comes from Constance's side of the family. It was one of those funny middle names which seemed to get given to boys or girls, immaterial, as a sort of continuation of family...
connection.
Family connection of some sort. Anyway, there was a her brother was called, Constance's brother was called Otho Holland Lloyd.
Otho? How did you get Merlin, by the way? That must have been a tricky name to grow up with.
It was indeed. Teased at school and called Marilyn.
Yes, of course.
Aren't you? That was my father's idea. He gave me the name Christopher as well as Merlin in case I couldn't cope with it. But he wasn't best pleased when somebody reminded him years later that, in fact, Merlin, the magician, was supposed to have been sired by the devil.
So the two sons were called, were renamed Holland, and they were sent off to separate schools. You write in a very moving way about the decision of Wilde's wife, Constance, not to join him in France after he'd been released from jail. And you make the point that this was a fundamentally tough decision and hugely painful for both people, both sides, both for Constance and for Oscar. But why wouldn't she just go? Didn't she have the self-confidence, the intelligence, the kind of really the decency to join the man she wanted to join?
Well, she did, absolutely. And I'm delighted you've picked up on that, because it's something which people for years have tried to make out, that Oscar didn't really want to see. He wrote to her and said, I'd like to see you and I'd like to see the boys. And people have said Constance hesitated and she wasn't sure whether she... It's all a load of complete nonsense, in my view. And what they both wanted to see each other, the evidence is there. Constance was desperate to see him. She wanted to go up to Dieppe, where he was living at the time, near Dieppe. And he desperately wanted to see her. It wouldn't have turned into a sort of lovely, cosy little marriage again, that's certain.
No.
But it certainly might have kick-started him into creativity again. But the problem was she listened to her friends. And the friends couldn't cope with the fact that if these Mr. and Mrs. Wilde hadn't been divorced. So if Oscar and Constance got back together, how would the British expatriates on the continent cope with this man who was a convict, a bankrupt, and a homosexual? So the best, they couldn't ostracize poor Constance, but they couldn't really take him back into polite society. So the best thing to do is to advise Constance, listen, dear, just give him a period of probation, let him find his feet again, give him three or four months, maybe half a year, and then see how it all works out. And she, poor dear, listened to them. And that is one of the second tragedies of Oscar Wilde's life.
But in the end, Merlin, it is her responsibility that she took that decision.
All right, yes, I suppose you're right. It was her decision. But then later on, shortly before she dies, she writes to a friend and says, if I saw him now, I know I should forgive everything. When I love somebody once, I love them always. I mean, it's a very moving letter she wrote to a friend of hers. This is shortly before she died. She was a very noble woman. Her name, Constance, she was constant in his life.
Your father, you write, was brought up essentially to shut up about his father, Oscar Wilde, to sort of put it behind him. And he lived until he was in his 50s or 60s, lived this kind of lie that he had nothing to do with Oscar, but then changed his mind. Why?
I think that was due to my mother. I don't think it's quite true to say that he denied it until he was in his 50s and 60s. I think it took the 1920s for him to come to terms with it. On several occasions, he was described once in a bookseller's catalogue, once in a big court case about a forgery. He was described as Vivian Holland Wilde's only surviving son, and he had Wilde's only surviving son taken out and simply Vivian Holland, Oscar Wilde's literary executor, put in. He was prepared to be associated with his father, but he didn't go around, metaphorically speaking, saying, you know, I am Oscar Wilde's son. The change came when he came to Australia in 1947-48. My mother was asked to go back to Australia to do fashion shows combined with her knowledge of cosmetics. And they spent a year in Australia, and the Australians made Vivian understand that his father was a great writer. I mean, it was still something which wasn't really accepted. Oscar was regarded in England, I think, as a sort of second-division author, you know? And, of course, the smell of scandal still hanging around him. But when he got to Australia, people were excited to know him and to emphasise the fact that they believed his father was a great writer. And I think it was that which made him understand that there was all the shame which had surrounded this for years was, in a sense, a sort of terrible British hypocrisy. And when he came back from Australia, my mother persuaded him to settle down and start writing about his youth. And that produced The Son of Oscar Wilde in 1954. It took a long time for him to write it and come to terms with it. But I think one can say that it was Australia that was the catalyst and which made him come to terms with his early, rather sad years.
You write, this took my breath away, you write in the book that your father remembered Wilde's smell.
Yes.
What was the smell of Oscar Wilde?
I can't tell you precisely, but it was obviously a very expensive cologne from Bond Street.
and cigarette smoke.
And cigarette smoke, absolutely. Gold-tipped Turkish cigarettes from a very beautiful cigarette case, I should think.
Now, look, we'll get back to your father's book in a moment. I just want to bring you into the narrative here, because at this stage you're 7 or 8 years old when that book was published. But when did you find out that Oscar Wilde, whose plays by this time were being once again produced in the West End, that Oscar Wilde was your grandfather?
Well, the earliest memory I have of it at all is the unveiling of the blue plaque put on his house in Tite Street in 1954, at the time of the centenary of his death. My father wrote in his diary that the summer before, we'd been walking down, I think it was Shaftesbury Avenue in London, and I saw on a theatre the name Oscar Wilde. And I turned to him and I said, wasn't Oscar Wilde your father? And my father wrote in his diary that I just said yes. And fortunately, he left it at that. So I must somehow have been aware of it when I was about seven. But the only time that being consciously aware of it was at the unveiling of this plaque in blue plaque in Tite Street.
Because you were part of the sort of distinguished little crowd for the unveiling.
I suppose I must have been. I mean, it was a rather dreary, wet day, as far as I remember. And what I do remember is that the opposite the Wilde's house, it's no longer there, there was a children's hospital where I'd had my tonsils out. And the nurses were all sort of crowding to the windows to see what was going on over the road at Oscar Wilde's house. And that, I remember, the vast quantity of people, and of course me being knee-high to a grasshopper at that stage, I was under the height at which I could see everything going on. And then there was a lunch at the Savoy afterwards, which I do remember, sitting, signing people's menus. My father obviously signed people's menus, and I was asked to sign menus. Went back to school, and the headmistress of the little school I was at wrote to my father and said I was absolutely poisonous when I came back. I was boasting about spending the whole afternoon signing people's menus.
This is Late Night Live on Radio National. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Oscar Wilde's grandson, Merlin Holland, who has just published, with, in Australia, Allen and Unwin, After Oscar, The Legacy of a Scandal. So you know by now, by this point, that you are Wilde's grandson. But what was the story your family told you about this man?
I think the brief answer to that is nothing. People have often asked me, did I talk to my father about him? And the answer is no. Oh, was that because of the continuing shame in the family? I said, no, not at all. And then I asked them, did you know your grandfather? Yes, yes. And did you talk to your mother or father about your grandfather? Yes, of course we did. So I said, well, we had no common memories, and that was the missing link. My father saw him last at the age of, what would it have been, 8 or 9. My mother was born 10 years after Oscar died, and I obviously had never known him. So there was nothing, we had no common memories, no common link. I don't even know that I was taken to a play of his in those years of the 1950s, early 1960s. There was nothing really that we could have grasped onto as a family and had a talk about.
But isn't this extraordinary in families, how you can know not to ask questions? And it's not by somebody saying, you can't ask about that. You just know you can't ask questions.
I think that's absolutely right. And later on, when I got married and had a child myself, friends of mine said to me, much later, they said to me, we didn't like to ask you about your grandfather. And this was in the 1980s. It was a sort of taboo subject. And I said, but I don't, why was it a taboo? Oh, well, because your wife said that you weren't terribly happy with the idea of being asked about your grandfather. And I said, well, if somebody had asked me, I would have been happy to talk about it. I think it wasn't that I was unhappy. It was that they were probably too embarrassed. So there's a sort of continuing, the shame had turned into something different. The shame had turned into embarrassment on the part of other people, I think.
It is the importance of being earnest, isn't it? That is the cornerstone of the survival of Wilde's reputation. And he wrote great poetry, some extraordinary poetry. He wrote a number of other plays. He wrote De Profundis, etc., etc., etc. But it's this comedy that is the sort of the continuing powerhouse of his reputation, isn't it?
It is. And you know, there's one thing which I've always said about the importance of being earnest. In the first act, when Algy, in whose flat this is all taking place, is asked by Jack Worthing, his friend, who is wanting to marry Lady Bracknell's daughter, Gwendolyn, and he's just been through the mill with Lady Bracknell, quizzing him about his past and so on and so on.
Yes.
And Jack says to Algy, do you think that there's a possibility that in 150 years' time, Gwendolyn will become like her mother? And Algy replies, all women become like their mothers. That's their tragedy. No man does. That's his. And the audience laughs.
Yes.
And on occasion, I've said to them, why are you laughing? Don't you realize there's a very serious message behind that? What he's saying, basically, is that men are not in touch with their feminine side, and that's a tragedy. And so if you, there are little bits of the importance of being earnest, which have a, if I can put it like that, a seriousness about them, which frequently is overlooked because they're part of a joke, they're part of an amusing exchange.
But wisdom, wisdom delivered in a way that can't be fobbed off because it's delivered in a way that makes you laugh. That's why it survives, isn't it? It's the laughter that keeps it alive.
Yes.
Who is the greatest Lady Bracknell you've ever seen? The one that's made you laugh most.
I think Maggie Smith was a terrific Lady Bracknell, and I thought she was wonderful. I never saw Edith Evans. I've seen her on film, but I never saw her in the flesh. It was too early for me. Funnily enough, Stephen Fry is now playing Lady Bracknell in London.
Oh, is he?
And he pulls it off extraordinarily well. It's the sort of Victorian matriarch. And the importance of being earnest, you can do more or less anything with, so long as you stick to the text. A Lady Bracknell once. Lady Bracknell in crushed velvet snorting coke. Can you imagine?
Yes, that fits.
It survived because they didn't fiddle with the text. That's the whole point. But I think, Stephen is remarkably good as Lady Bracknell. And I was saying to somebody recently, when they cast Lady Bracknell as a woman now, it's going to be the exception. There have been a number of male Lady Bracknells who've been better or worse. But it's the cross-casting, which is now become almost the norm.
Well, I saw Geoffrey Rush playing Lady Bracknell
really?
Yes, in a production in Melbourne. I was laughing so much snot was pouring down my face. It was unbelievably funny, a great comic actor. And isn't it extraordinary? You know the lines, you know the jokes, and yet they are spectacularly powerful, even though they don't come as a surprise. You know them, and yet they're thrilling.
Well, you know, not only that, they appear in newspapers as well. I was not that long ago, I was reading an account of a football match. Not something I do normally, but it caught my eye because at the beginning, the reporter had started off by saying, to lose one home match may be considered a misfortune. To lose two in a row, dot, dot, dot. And I mean, even without the author's name,
we know the joke.
you know, it's all to do with Jack's parents. Lose one parent may be a misfortune. To lose two looks like carelessness to me.
Still such a fabulous joke.
Yeah, he's gone. He seems to have infiltrated himself everywhere. And very nicely so. I'm constantly cutting little bits out of newspapers and Oscar Wilde quotes, or even with or without his name. You know, it is extraordinary how he seems to have come back into probably more prominence than he had even in the 1890s, in a way.
Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I am talking to Oscar Wilde's grandson, Merlin Holland, about his new book, After Oscar, The Legacy of a Scandal. Now, let's get to the book. In 1994, when you were what, roughly about to turn 50, something like that, went to light a candle in memory of your grandfather in Saint-Germain-des-Prés in Paris. Why and what happened?
I was taking part in a documentary, and we'd been up to Père Lachaise Cemetery that day, where Oscar is buried. And there were more people there that day than I can remember on other days. And we then went to Saint-Germain-des-Prés, the church where his funeral service was held. At the entrance to the little chapel where it all took place, there were more candles, I think, than I can remember. Every time I went there, I lit a candle sort of in his memory. And then, of course, I suddenly realized that this was the anniversary of his death, the 30th of November. Everybody else had remembered and I hadn't. I mean, it was quite shocking in a way. And then I suddenly realized that I was here lighting a candle. No other member of his family had been present at his death, at his funeral. And it suddenly occurred to me that I had a right to claim him as a grandfather. And it was a very emotional moment. And I've never forgotten it. I suppose from that moment onwards, I could say, hey, yes, I've never wanted to say I am Oscar Wilde's grandson. I've always referred to him as my grandfather. And if I've had to explain why to people, I've said, well, you obviously don't understand. I'm happy to be his grandson, but I'm certainly not going to say I am Oscar Wilde's grandson. And there's a subtle difference.
Yes, indeed. But indeed.
Lighting that candle helped.
And then you talk about finding yourself the unwilling conduit of a century of unwept family grief. What did you mean by that?
It choked me up completely. And I'm not somebody who tears up just like that. But at that moment, it did. And I was, fortunately, or perhaps unfortunately from their point of view, the people I was doing the documentary with weren't filming it. But it just made me, and I thought of what we were talking about earlier, the sadness that Oscar and Constance couldn't get back together. He never saw his wife or his children again. And I think it came home to me how sad the end of that life had been, and that I wept, you know, unashamedly.
And a series of books followed: The Wit of Oscar Wilde in 1997, The Wilde Album in the same year, and then an edition of The Complete Letters of Wilde in 2000, and A Life in Letters a few years later, Irish Peacock and Scarlet Marquis in 2003, Coffee with Oscar Wilde, 2007, A Portrait of Oscar Wilde, 2008. And yet, this is an act of devotion and of exploration, but you also confess to finding yourself at times, and I'm not sure whether it is still the case, irritated by Wilde. You write, I eventually came to have a great deal of anger about Oscar, over his pig-headedness, his insensitivity, his decision to take on the establishment and not consider the consequences. Is that still your view?
It's my view, but I think probably modified and calmed down now. I don't know whether you have had, but I've certainly had in my life a very, very good close friend who was extremely talented. He was extremely artistic. He was a ballet dancer and finished up by teaching ballet. But as I think a lot of artistic people can be, he was very self-centered. It didn't mean I loved him any the less, but I think that's something which, and I may be, this may be a bit of a sweeping generalization, but I think there is attached to many extremely gifted, sensitive, artistic people, a side which is very selfish. And I think that's probably the side of Oscar which I get cross with, the way he effectively destroyed his own family. I think that's the reason I get irritated by him. I've said to people, I'm probably one of the only people in the world who's allowed to say so.
Yes.
It is irritating. But I totally understand it. I totally understand it. Doesn't mean to say that it doesn't irritate me, though.
Yes, I don't think there is any biographer of great creative figures that doesn't share some of that feeling that they can cause a great deal of pain and harm to the people around them. But I wonder about your formula, his decision to take on the establishment. Do you mean his decision to sue the Marquess of Queensberry after Queensberry accused him of being, am I right, accused him of being a sodomite?
That's right, misspelled in his anger, yes.
Yes. In a card, was it in a bunch of vegetables?
The Marquess went to his club. First night, the importance of being earnest, with a bouquet of vegetables, wanting to, I don't know whether you throw them wild on the stage after, if you gave a curtain speech at the end or whatever. And Oscar managed to get his ticket cancelled, and the Marquess stomped off and left. I can't remember whether it was that night or I think it was a couple of days later, left his visiting card at Wilde's Club, on which he had written for Oscar Wilde posing sodomite.
Yeah.
And Oscar
being in a relationship with Queensberry's son, of course.
Exactly. And Oscar writes to his very great friend, and later, after his death, his literary executor, Robert Ross, most probably Oscar's first homosexual lover, before Alfred Douglas, and says, come and see me tonight. The terrible thing has happened. And when Robbie Ross gets there, he says, I've asked Bosie, that's Alfred Douglas, to come tomorrow. And when Robbie Ross gets there, young Alfred Douglas is already there, working his magic. He hates his father. He wants nothing more than to see his father behind bars for what was called in those days criminal libel. And if it had just been Robbie Ross, well, Robbie would have said to him, tear it up, put it in the bin, don't get involved in this, don't get involved in father-son squabble. No, it's a, and it's one of those awful what-if moments. What if Robbie had got there first and said to Oscar, give me the card, and torn it up and put it in the waste basket.
Isn't Robbie Ross one of the most wonderful figures in this story? And Bosie, of course, one of the grimmest human beings.
Yes, I have a sneaking sympathy for Oscar falling in love with him. Not that I'm gay myself, that's not the point about it. The point is that this was a beautiful young man. This is Bosie. He was intelligent. He wrote very good poems. Some of his sonnets are extraordinarily good. He was moody. He was difficult. After Oscar goes back to him, when he comes out of prison and he doesn't see Constance, and young Alfred Douglas says to him, come on, let's go off to Naples for the winter. And then all hell breaks loose. And later on, Oscar writes to Robbie Ross and says, you know, it was inevitable. I went back to him. How could I not love him? He's ruined my life.
I mean, it's a great line.
It's a great, great line. But Robbie is in Oscar's life and his later life. He is a sort of stabilizing influence. And then, of course, after Oscar's death, when he meets my father, not until 7 years later, the family obviously want to make sure that none of Oscar's friends have access to his children. Robbie eventually becomes like a sort of surrogate father to my father. And my father refers to him as, you know, I knew he was going to be a great friend of mine. And he did indeed become a great friend. And Vivian was absolutely distraught when Robbie died at the end of the war. First World War.
And Robbie Ross did a great service for your family, didn't he? Because he got the copyrights back.
Indeed.
Explain how the family lost and regained the copyrights to the plays.
When Oscar went bankrupt, he was bankrupted partly from Queensberry's costs. I think it was Queensberry who instigated the bankruptcy proceedings. Sir George Alexander purchased from the bankruptcy receiver the rights to Lady Windermere's Fan and the Importance of Being Earnest. And to give him his due, he made a few sort of ex gratia payments to Oscar Wilde when he was in exile. I mean, they weren't large sums of money, but they'd had a very good relationship, George Alexander and Oscar. He, as the actor-manager who had produced Lady Windermere's Fan and The Importance. And on George Alexander's death, I think it was in 1918, he bequeathed those rights that he had purchased from the bankruptcy receiver back to my father in memory of Oscar, which I thought was an extraordinary gesture, lovely gesture on his part.
And those royalties sustained the family into the 1950s.
Indeed, until 1950, when, of course, all the copyrights disappeared in a puff of smoke, 50 years after Oscar's death.
Ah, these days it would have been 70 years. A point in the story of Oscar. We've discussed the extraordinary, foolish decision to sue Queensberry. But when he had been prosecuted and when he was facing jail, Wilde was given time to leave the country. And he didn't. I mean, this is the subject of, to my mind, great play of David Hare's Judas Kiss.
Yes.
He doesn't leave the country. He sits in the Cadogan Hotel waiting to be arrested. Merlin, why? Why didn't he get out when he could?
The indecision, yes. Well, I think there are two things there. One is he's taken it this far to turn tail and escape to the continent, which he could have done. There is another misconception that the police waited until the last train had left for the continent before they came in to arrest him, which is complete nonsense. A quick look at the railway guides at the time would tell you that there were other trains later on.
That's a biographer's work. Check the timetables.
Well, this is why it took so long to write the book, checking every damn fact. But I think even more must have been in Oscar's ear the words of his mother. Whether or not she actually said this, I don't know. If you leave now, I will never speak to you again. But if you stay, you will always be my son. And that came from this extraordinary mother that Oscar had, who had been part of the Young Ireland movement back in the 1840s and 50s. Anti-British poetry written by her. She was a very staunch Irish nationalist and very proud with it. And Oscar adored his mother. And I think possibly, even at the Cadogan Hotel, there was the thought that to go would have been cowardice. And the idea of having to face his mother, who was still alive at that stage, would have been more than he could really countenance.
But did he also understand that his legend depended on him going to jail?
I think that may be reading a bit too much into it.
Okay, now look, now we'll leave it there because we have some important work to do before our time is up. And that is your scrutiny of the biographies of Oscar Wilde. And your scrutiny begins with your father's biography. This is a most extraordinary situation. You are vetting your father's work. How did it come out? How good was it?
I would put it in the category which we were discussing of the lies, the exaggerations, the inventions and so on, in the category of being not so bad, i.e. tying up loose ends and false memory rather than actually wanting to mislead people.
Being a bit neat with the facts.
Yes, exactly. And this was at a time, don't forget, in 1953, 54, when he was writing it, that homosexuality was still a crime in England. It remained on the statute book until 1967. 2 months before my father himself died, he'd been living with that law on the statute book in England, which had sent his own father to prison. No. So he had to be careful about how he presented the facts in his autobiography.
Why? Why? Why did he have to be careful?
I may be wrong in saying that it was one of the worst periods of homophobia in England.
Oh, it was dreadful.
It certainly seems like that to me. John Gielgud was prosecuted.
Yes.
Lord Montague was prosecuted. Peter Wildblood was prosecuted. People were sent to prison for 6 months or a year for simply for having had same-sex relations with another man.
It was at his worst. But let's jump forward a little time, because Oscar Wilde is the subject of one of the great biographies, Richard Ellman's Life of Oscar Wilde, published in the 1980s. You had a good deal to do with Ellman in the preparation of that book, but you have a huge quarrel with Ellman because why?
I'd correct you slightly. I didn't have a lot to have to do with it. I was able to give him some help, secreting various letters out of the family, as I say, family archives, sounds too grand, but letters from Constance to her brother, which, as he said to me in a letter, helped him fill in a few gaps in his own account of Oscar's life.
Yes.
He was under a certain amount of pressure, I think, from his publishers to produce something which was going to be a little bit more than an average rum-ti-tum biography. They wanted something which was going to be a little bit sensational, and that comes out of the correspondence, which still exists, between Richard Ellman and his publisher. And there was always a rumour that Oscar had died of tertiary syphilis. The early death of an author from a sexually transmitted disease. I mean, it has all the makings of great drama, doesn't it? So Richard Ellman, on, I'm afraid to say, the flimsiest of evidence, maintained that Oscar got syphilis when he was at Oxford, that it determined a lot of the rest of his life, and that he finally died of it. And I said to various people, I don't care whether Oscar had syphilis or not. If he had it, and it can be shown, even at this stage, at this distance, based on reasonable solid conjecture and reasonable evidence, then that's fine. Richard Ellman's biography is going to be the definitive one for years to come. And so let's put this to rest once and for all. But if the evidence really isn't there, or it's been manipulated, I think, it's just going to continue this rumour, which always seemed to me to be based on very flimsy evidence, and I think it should be stamped on. I didn't do it willingly because I admired Richard Ellman. He was a great scholar, and I got on well with him. And in the end, what we agreed was that he should put a footnote in saying this was his view and it might not stand up in court, sort of 100% solid evidence, but it was his view, and that's what, So I accepted that. You can't stop people. I know literary executors have tried to stop biographers writing nasty things about them.
Yes, I have some experience. Yes.
I bet you have, yes. That's always been my view. If it's factually wrong, and it can be shown to be factually wrong, then I think it needs to be pointed out. But if it's simply somebody's view, then...
But Merlin...
Biography will stand or fall by the critics and the public view of it in the end. So trying to prevent things as a literary executor, not that I had any real power to do so, is a waste of time and makes a lot of enemies.
But Merlin, I agree, absolutely, things must be accurate. But is this not, again, the coming back to this sense of shame around Wilde? I mean, what is the shame in those days of dying of syphilis? It was prevalent I mean, Toulouse-Lautrec, Paul Gauguin, Manet, Goya, Schubert, Guy de Maupassant. I mean, people died of syphilis.
And
there was, yes, at that time, some shame attached to it, but it was just a sexually transmitted disease. I mean, this is not truly shameful.
Oh, I didn't regard it as shameful at all. I mean, it was a fact. If it was a fact, then it should be stated, and it didn't make any difference to me. What I think objected to is what I said earlier, which is the over-sensationalizing of a life which was quite sensational enough in its own right, without having biographers or filmmakers adding to it with either invented or twisted facts to make it that much more sensational to attract readers audiences. As I've always said, it would made no difference to me whether Oscar had it or whether he didn't. And it's quite possible that he did have syphilis. I mean, such a very large, an unexpectedly large percentage of Victorian men had sexually transmitted diseases. But I think one thing is absolutely certain, and the medical profession has now more or less firmly stamped on this, is that he didn't die of it. And if he didn't die of it, you can't start building history backwards to find out when he caught it, which is effectively what was being done.
Merlin, after all this, after all the work you've done and books you've written, are you proud of being Oscar Wilde's grandson?
It's a very difficult question to answer, and I think I have answered it in the book in a way. To be proud of somebody, I think you have to have known them personally. At least that's my view. I'm proud of my father and what he went through and how he managed to cope with it all. I'm proud of my mother coming all the way from Australia, becoming for a number of years the Queen's personal beauty advisor. I knew them both. I loved them both. I may have been a little bit hard on my mother in the book with her famous whitewash brush, but I'm proud of them both. To be proud of Oscar, I feel I would have had to have known him personally and felt a sense of closeness to him. I suppose I'm proud of him that he was my grandfather. I'm proud of what he was able to do. But I think it would be a misuse of the word in my vocabulary to say, I am proud of my grandfather. I'm proud of the way he coped with what he did. I'm proud of his post-prison. I'm proud, for example, that when he came out of prison, he arranged for about the equivalent in today's money of about £2,000 to be sent to 10 of his co-prisoners to put them back on their feet when they came out of prison. Every time I think about that, I'm immensely touched by it.
Are you proud?
It's a very long answer to your question, but I am proud of my grandfather, yes. I'm proud of him, but I'm only proud of him in a sort of slightly objective way, if I can put it like that.
Merlin, thank you. I've been talking to Merlin Holland, Oscar Wilde's grandson, the author of After Oscar, The Legacy of a Scandal, which is published by Allen and Unwin. Merlin, thank you so much.
Been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.